Drummer Alvin Queen and his quintet with There's Blues Everywhere. It's from his 2006 album, I Ain't Looking At You. I love that title. I Ain't Looking At You. Jesse Davis on alto sax, Terrell Stafford on trumpet, Mike Ladon on the Hammond B3 organ, and Peter Bernstein on guitar. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're about to delve into a very interesting piece of work, I could call it. You may recall that we did this thing, which I titled the Starbucks Defensive, in which we laid out, you know, different aspects of what happened in this saga of the Starbucks arrest of two African-American men at a Philadelphia Starbucks just a couple of weeks ago. Well, there's an update, of course, and we should have seen it coming, but we got close to predicting it. We did say that there's more than meets the eye, and indeed there is. Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz, later this month, will end his 36-year tenure as executive chairman of the company, and he'll, quote, think about a range of options that could include public service, unquote. We should read that as a possible presidential run. This adds new perspective on the quick shutdown of public outrage over the trespassing arrests of two African American men who were waiting for a third man for a meeting at a Starbucks store in Philadelphia. We commented at that time that the men's still undisclosed settlement, followed by a company-wide bias training session featuring high-profile blacks, wasn't just about a forward-looking company looking to head off a crisis. It was much more than that. So now we see what's behind all of that. And it was splendidly done. Splendidly done. At the time this occurred, there was no indication that A, Schultz was going to be resigning before the end of the month, and B, that this kerfuffle at the Starbucks in Philadelphia had other dimensions to it beyond what we discussed. We talked about the fact that these two men, quote, settled, unquote. Although we noted there was no charge. They never filed any complaints or anything like that, but they settled. and for an undisclosed sum. There was also part of the settlement that $200,000 would be set aside by Starbucks to help Black entrepreneurs actually get their businesses off the ground and running well. $200,000 is not a good amount of money if you're serious about starting an incubator for business of any type. But okay, there's $200,000 set aside for that. But all the while, we had no idea, no indication that something bigger was looming in the background. And this is it. He's going to be leaving the company after 36 years and moving on to something not just different, but perhaps even better. He might be a presidential candidate. But remember I said, within a month, they quashed this whole thing, which at the time was threatening to be a national reaction to the way these men were arrested and charged with trespassing because they had not yet ordered anything but were waiting for their friend. And the manager of the store summoned the police, and the police in turn apparently followed her orders. Arrest these men, charge them with trespassing, and get them out of here. Now, whether that was her own version of what needed to be done, or whether she was informed by some policy of Starbucks, we still don't know. All we know is that it happened, but we also know that in no time flat within the store itself, people went crazy witnessing this. It was videotaped and it went viral. So all around the country and presumably in other parts of the world, this was the face of Starbucks, and it wasn't good. Then we heard about this idea that the company was going to stage throughout the company. All 8,000 stores in the United States were to be attending a special training seminar, a four-hour training seminar for which they would be paid. It was not mandatory. And it had to do with bias. You know, the kind of bias that we have, but we don't know we have. And then they situated this whole thing. This was the way of diffusing the situation, in other words. It no longer was a nasty manager being nasty and doing things that were, to our mind, to the public's mind, quite illegal. But it became a kind of existential exercise. You know, here's a company because it has a forward-looking attitude. It decided that it would seize upon the hints here in this altercation. And the hints were that we really need to behave better with each other. And we need to examine how our unconscious biases sometimes affect our actions. Well, it sounds good. It sounded like a plausible idea, except it was wrong. It still was, in my mind, a nasty manager breaking the law and causing two African-American men not at all incidentally, to be arrested for a, quote, crime that doesn't exist. The training, remember I told you I read up on this kind of training, because now many companies are in this business of taking the heat off of companies that are rife with racism within them. The thrust is to say, yes, we do live in a society where we bring our private issues with us to every and anything that we do. And from time to time, these feelings would erupt and express themselves in the most inconvenient way. And so the task here, the most important task, is to identify this propensity within us to do that. Now, all of that is tantamount, as I discussed, to taking the heat off Starbucks and trying to reorganize the facts of what happened so that it is not a crime or potential crime on the part of Starbucks manager, but it is simply the result of a clash of biases. The young men have biases just like the manager has biases. And this was an unfortunate clashing of personal bias, you see. Now, in order to do that, they hired some high-profile blacks to do the seminar, to appear at the seminar, including the actor and rapper and whatever he is now in the entertainment business, called, he goes by the name Common. You see him on commercials, you see him on a lot of some smaller productions, but he has appeared in movies. And he was part of this training. He has no training that I know of, no professional training in human resources and related matters. But it was important to have a high-profile black. He also had company. We had the head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund appearing as part of this training. Whatever they said or whatever they presented, in my view, is immaterial to the fact. A crime has been committed here. And the blacks involved all capitulated. At that time, for unknown reasons, the blacks were the apologists, or at least they set the stage for reinterpreting what this event, the collision, was in that Philadelphia store. It had nothing really to do with implicit bias in that strict sense. It was a nasty manager having a sense of her power and authority, deciding to abuse it. And in abusing it, abuses the rights of two African-American men. That's the bottom line. But the company was able to wiggle out of its responsibility, because part of the whole training session is that people should understand that in many ways we are not to be blamed for our actions. Because our actions are informed by this nebulous thing called our innate bias, and since we all have them, in practically any instance in which there is a clashing going on. We can see, and we have to train and retrain ourselves to see that each person involved contributed in one way or the other to it. So neutralize it and remove the responsibility attached to a person's actions, especially if the person happens to be an employee. That's what this training is supposed to teach us. To neutralize, it neutralizes wrongdoing by giving an entirely different point of view, an entirely different focus, which is kind of existential. But we don't live in an existential world. The woman did these two men wrong. End of story. But then we had the approach of Starbucks working very well. They spent a lot of money on this. And quite rightly so. There was an agenda. It was hidden. We had no idea that the CEO, Howard Schultz, was going to be resigning and even beginning to contemplate the idea of running for president. Now, how good would it look for him to encounter this kind of a barrage of criticism if this thing were not solved and put away, hidden in a closet someplace and locked up tight? So he moved very expeditiously to make this problem disappear. And I was absolutely right when I said, you look at the conduct of the blacks. In every instance, they failed. They failed. They compromised themselves. They compromised the community. And I'm not just talking about the black community. Let me make it clear. There were whites inside of that Starbucks who actually started the protest. They were livid at what they witnessed. And they began a reaction to it that was forming into a protest movement against Starbucks. But this is how companies do it. They're smart and they get their way. The company, in fact, is looked not as a villain. It is looked at as a very insightful, modern, forward-thinking kind of company. Now, little did the men keep in mind, even as they agreed to, quote, settle, unquote, they didn't even file a charge. An offer was made, they took it. They had no regard for whether this could be of benefit to the larger community, to take a principled stand. And the principled stand would have been to see to it that Starbucks and its errant manager pay the cost in terms of its public relations for having a manager basically engage in illegal activity, racist legal activity. That would have tarnished Starbucks's image. So the black folks participated in shining up Starbucks. They got their 10 ducats. And they got the privilege of appearing in a forum that says, in many skirmishes in life like this, we have to keep in mind that nobody is to be blamed. And if nobody is to be blamed, there is no discussion about what the responsibility is of someone who perpetrates a wrong. You can't be wrong. You see how it all works? Isn't that splendid? And here we're talking about a company with 8,000 stores. That's just in the United States. They have thousands and thousands of stores all over the world. And they're making an aggressive effort now to reach into what they would consider, or what they have considered so far, their non-traditional markets, which is why this one was in Philadelphia, in a Philadelphia neighborhood that had been written off. Starbucks, the presence of Starbucks, is now a signal that this community is valuable, is seen as being valuable enough to a big company like Starbucks, that Starbucks is in the forefront of gentrification. So we can see that these things are not small things. When they happen, we have to be very, very astute about how we read these things. So out of this controversy, which was quashed in record time, somebody is considering to be president. And the others are happy with capitulating. And there you go. It's an old story, but in a sense, it's new. It's new because folks simply did not think or care to think about the enormity of the situation. And voluntarily took part in a process to elevate a company that still has not paid a price for offending a community. It was masterful. We got to give them credit for that. It was masterful. But how about that? Within a short time after their so-called training, we learned that the CEO will be leaving to contemplate a possible run at public office. He certainly wouldn't be running for city clerk. He certainly wouldn't be running for a sanitation worker. He's running for president. And something that should have torpedoed that very idea no longer exists. And it no longer exists because the black folks, all of them, capitulated. Well, we'll take this break and come back to the second part of our program today, right after this.
Thank you.
listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. On June the 5th, in 1968, Robert F. Kennedy, who was 42 at that time, was mortally wounded at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, where supporters were celebrating his clinching of the Democratic nomination with primary election wins in California and South Dakota. He had just left the podium and was heading toward a kitchen exit when shots rang out. He fell, mortally wounded, and died in the early morning hours of June the 6th. He was pronounced dead at the hospital. Sirhan Sirhan, then a 24-year-old Palestinian-Jordanian immigrant, was held as the gunman. He claimed that he was brainwashed and that he did not act alone. He was sentenced to death after trial in 1969, and his sentence was commuted to life in prison in 1972. We don't know very much about Robert F. Kennedy's political life, which was short, but not very much talked about. I thought I would share a speech that he made in 1964 at Columbia University, and it gives a very interesting insight into what informed his politics. He was cast as an eternal optimist, closely allied with the suffering of the underclass, and wanting to dedicate his life to public service. In this exchange with the students at Columbia University, you get a sense of what made the man. Certainly, there are many other aspects to him, but today I thought we'd pause and get an appreciation of his thinking, of his actions, and of his vision for the future of America. Here is Robert F. Kennedy interacting with students at Columbia University in 1964.
The New York Democratic State Committee brings you the following videotape report of parts of a meeting between a group of New York college students and the Democratic candidate for United States Senate, Robert Kennedy.
We're here tonight, and there's very little more I can say except to introduce first, Mrs. Ethel Kennedy, who's sitting over here. And secondly, the former Attorney General of the United States and candidate for the United States Senate from New York, Robert F. Kennedy.
A bright group of students. I've learned to say that since I've been a candidate. I thought maybe that you'd have some questions and we could just proceed, and if the things that are not brought out, maybe I just say them in the end. Do you want to try to do that? Go ahead.
Sir, could you tell us why you chose to run from New York rather than Massachusetts or Virginia or someplace else?
My brother was in the Navy, and originally in intelligence, and he went to make a speech to a group as to what you do when a bomb falls and the fire breaks out. And so he explained what you do, that you throw sand on fire or you throw water on the fire. And if you throw water on the fire that you're supposed to throw the sand on, it spreads it. So you have to be very careful what you do. And then he said at the end of the speech, after he'd spoken for about 15 minutes, he said, now are there any questions? And somebody put up their hand and said, well, how do you tell one fire from the other? And he said, well, there's a fellow coming next week who'll explain that. But I will explain that. In the first place, I have a close association identification with the state of New York. I've lived in the state of New York much longer than I lived any other place. I lived here for the first 20 years of my life. I went away then to college, and I went away to law school, and I went away to work. I've worked the last 13 years in Washington now. So even if I was living in the state of New York for a longer period of time, I'd still be in Washington, as I have been. I've our place of business, we had a home here in the state of New York, my family, since I was a year old. We've had a home or an apartment here since that time, and our major place of business for my family has been the state of New York. But even beyond that, which I think is more important, if the election's going to be decided based on my accent or where I also have other associations with, I think that the people are going to vote for my opponent. I think that the election really should be decided on the basis of my opponent or myself can do more for the state of New York and make the greatest amount of difference for this state and for this country over the period of the next 6 years. Again, if it's going to be judged on who's lived here in the state of New York longer than my opponent has, but then maybe you should elect the oldest man in the state of New York.
Mr. Kennedy, I'd like to ask you a question which seems to me very close to the heart of the matter, and if it sounds blunt, so be it. Aren't you really using New York State as a kind of jumping-off place for your own presidential ambitions?
First, let me say, I would like, I have really two choices over the period of the last 10 months. I could have stayed in, I could have retired, and my father has done very well, and I could have lived off him. Or I could have continued to work the government. I mean, that's my major interest, and the major interest of my family. Again, I don't see anything really sinister about that. We've all worked for the United States government. I'd like to continue to work for the United States government. Now, I think that to being a United States senator, I mean, seeing that in my own family, I think is a position, a very lofty position, and a position where you can accomplish a great deal. We talked, and you asked me about the fact that I want to use this as a jumping off place. I don't know where I can jump off to, as we have a Democratic president. He's going to be elected in 1964. In my judgment, he's going to be reelected. He's going to get be reelected in 1968, so that the earliest that I'm going to be jumping off someplace is 1972, which is 8 years from now. I'm going to have to be a wonderful United States senator from 8 years. I'm going to have to get him. I'm going to have to be reelected in 6 years. I'm going to have to run and appear before the people of the state of New York. I'm going to have done a good job in the state of New York. I don't see me working and making this kind of effort that New York loses anything by. I hear somebody else outside said, are you going to serve your whole 6 years? Well, I don't know where I'd go. But frankly, I don't need the title, because I could be called general, I understand, for the rest of my life. I've been a general. And I don't need the money, and I don't need the office space. So I would just, I mean, frank as it is, and maybe it's difficult to understand in the state of New York, I'd like to just be a good United States senator. I'd like to serve.
Mr. Kennedy, just how extensive is your moral commitment to civil rights in New York State?
Well, I've been involved in this struggle now for 3.5 years. I think I've indicated how I feel about it all over the country and the efforts that I've made. And I think that a good deal more can be done elsewhere. In my judgment, the answer as far as the state of New York is concerned now rests with education, and it rests with employment, and it rests with decent housing, and it rests with proper recreation facilities, and it rests basically in giving our young people some hope. Now, let me just say that, for instance, there's 26.5% of the young Negroes in the city of New York who are out of school and out of work. The Negro child going to many of the schools in Harlem between the third grade and the sixth grade loses 10 points on his IQ. By the time he gets to the eighth grade, he's already 2 years behind white students. The dropout rate amongst Negroes in some of these areas where the schooling is not as good as in white areas, the dropout rate sometimes goes up to 75% or 80%. I think, therefore, we have to have a major effort in the field of education. The education effort must start with children who are 3 years old and 4 years old, because many of these children come from broken homes. They come from parents who are illiterate. They never hear an intelligent conversation at home. They never have anybody read them a book. So by the time even that they start in the first grade, they are culturally deprived. I think that's what we tried to do in the Haryuan Act effort here in the city of New York, focusing attention on the fact that these children, even at that young age, need attention and need help. Then if they're bringing homework back at the second or third grade and nobody's there to make them do their homework. You know, I've seen my own children, and if you don't make them do their homework, then they don't do their homework. And if nobody knows how to read in their home, a third to a half of the homes that these children come from are broken homes. And a high percentage of their one parent that stays with them is illiterate. So they're never going to get any homework done. Nobody's going to. So I think we have to set up special efforts to make sure there's places for them to study, because the housing is insufficient, overcrowded, and substandard. And I think that we have to have special counselors, and I think we have to make a special effort for reading, to make sure that they continue reading, because that's the key. And then I think also we have to do more as far as employment. We have almost 500,000 people who are unemployed here in the state of New York. Twice as many, percentage-wise, Negroes are unemployed as whites. Some areas of the state of New York, it goes up to 3 and 3.5 times as many. I think, therefore, what we can do as far as bringing new jobs and keeping industry here in the state is going to be terribly important. We're going to have to find here in the city of New York alone 650,000 new jobs by 1970. We're going to have to find 1 million jobs in the state of New York by 1970, where they're going to come from. We're going to have employment for those who are educated and those who are trained, but those who are illiterate and uneducated, they're the ones that are going to have difficulty. So that's where I think we have to make the effort.
Your views are radically opposed to Senator Keating's on such fields as education and housing, although Senator Keating voted for the housing bills of 61 and 64. Could you please elaborate on other specific issues which the views of yourself and Senator Keating's differ radically?
Well, I gave you basically where I disagree. I disagree in those two very important areas. I don't think it's just a question of voting on the final bill. I think it's a question of what you do while the bill is coming up and what kind of amendments you support. I think that's important in education, and it's also important in housing. I think these are two of the major pieces of legislation or major areas which affect the people of the state of New York. Third, very important matter, is my whole concept of being a United States Senator. I look over the period of the last 3.5 years of the problems that I suppose the basic problems that are facing the state of New York: housing, education, transportation, hospital construction. Well, in the field of education, it wasn't the junior senator from the state of New York who led the fight on that. It was the senator from the state of Oregon. And unemployment, which is another problem. It wasn't the junior senator from the state of New York who led the fight on the floor of the United States Senate. It was the senator from the state of West Virginia. It was the senator from the state of Pennsylvania. And it was the senator from the state of Michigan. In the field of hospital construction, it's a major problem here in the city of New York and the state of New York. It wasn't the junior senator from the state of New York who led that fight. It was the senator from the state of Alabama. In the area of transportation, it wasn't the junior senator from the state of New York who led that fight. It was the senator from the state of New Jersey. I mean, for instance, what is the Keating bill? I mean, now that's the problem. Now, President Kennedy wrote a book 10 years ago, Profiles in Courage. It was a story of 12 United States senators. 12 United States senators who made a contribution. It wasn't just a question of the fact that they voted on measures that were offered by somebody else and they were written about in a book. They did something themselves. They gave some direction. They made a difference in their constituency. They made a difference in the United States. I mean, when you think of the great senators from the state of New York, of Robert Wagner, you don't think of, God, he showed up for more roll calls than anybody else. You don't think of Herbert Lehman, he followed the leadership of somebody else. He was the conscience of the United States Senate. That's the kind of leadership. I say that we look at the Department of Justice over the period of the last 3.5 years, we passed more legislation dealing, came out of the Department of Justice than any other period in history. Passed 7 bills dealing with organized crime, the Civil Rights Bill, the efforts for the indigent and the poor and providing counsel for them, as well as many, many other areas. I think this was important. I think this was a direction. This wasn't just going out and making a speech about the matter. We talked about the other day about immigration. Well, we did something. When the Chinese came out of communist China into Hong Kong, we got them over here to the United States. It wasn't just a question of putting out a press release. Anybody can do that. But I ask all of you, even those of you who are opposed to me, if you can name one bill, if you can name one bill which holds his name, I talk about the Civil Rights Bill. I suppose nobody's spoken about civil rights more than my opponent. But he didn't have one thing to do with the passage of the Civil Rights Bill. I mean, he spoke for it. I think it's fine that he voted for it. I think a United States senator, however, is more than that. I think it's giving some leadership. And I think particularly for the state of New York, it's giving some direction. It's giving some leadership. It's showing some imagination. I think we have problems to face in this country. I think we have problems to face in this state over the period of the next 10 years. As President Kennedy said, we have the capacity to make this the best generation in the history of mankind or make it the last. And I don't think that we can just afford to stand still or sit. I think that we have to give some direction. And I think that the Senate of the United States is a place where the problems that we're going to work out, the problems that are facing this country internally, the problems that are facing us around the world, the Senate's going to give some leadership. The Senate's going to give some direction. And I don't think the state of New York should have any other than somebody who's going to make that kind of effort. I don't think that we can afford in the 1960s any state, anybody in the United States, and just being a follower. That's where I disagree.
Your opponent has made many charges opposing your candidacy, and one of those was made recently in Buffalo at the NAACP meeting. He accused you of walking out on the civil rights movement by resigning as attorney general during the thick of the fight. Do you have an answer to this accusation?
Well, I think it's typical of what we've done in this campaign. First, went before the NAACP, who were aware of what I've done in the field of civil rights, and put out an advance text that I'd run out in the effort for fight for civil rights. He appeared before the NAACP, and he praised me, said I had been a wonderful attorney general, that we'd fought together on the same side in civil rights, and I had been one of the great attorney generals in the field of civil rights. Then he walked out of there. He was asked by reporters whether he stood by his advance text or the praise that he'd given of me before the NAACP, and he said, I stand by my advance text. The result was that all across the state was the statement that you've just stated, that I ran out on civil rights. He didn't dare say that to the NAACP, which knew differently. I came the next day and I read both statements to them. But it's the same thing as far as this question of the Interhandle Company. First place, this was the charge that he made against me 2 weeks ago, that I had dealt with Nazis. First, let me say that he is the one that introduced the legislation for the sale of the company. He urged me to make the settlement. He wrote me letters to make the settlement. While this was going, this is 18 months ago. When the settlement was announced, he spoke on the floor of the United States Senate in favor of the settlement and said it was fine. He also brought up the question of whether any of this money would go to Nazis, and he said none of the money would go to Nazis. He satisfied himself that he'd looked into it and it wouldn't go to Nazis. I'm his attorney general 17 of the last 18 months. Never raised this question. He did raise the question, in all honesty, he raised the question maybe too much money was being paid. But if one penny was being paid to Nazis, it was wrong. But never the question about the fact that any of this money was going to Nazi interest. I become a candidate for the United States Senate, and suddenly in the middle of a senatorial campaign, I've made a deal with Nazis. 18 months later, he was on the Judiciary Committee. I was Attorney General of the United States. If there was anything wrong with it, all he had to do was call me before the Judiciary Committee. But not only not that, but he wrote me letters of praise. He spoke to newspapers about how good he thought this was. It was going to bring new jobs to the state of New York. He was 100% in favor of it. I think that first his statement on as far as the NAACP was an attempt to prejudice those who were interested in civil rights against my candidacy. I think as far as the statement on the Nazi deal was an effort to influence the voters of the state of New York, particularly Jewish voters who suffered so much from the Nazi, against my candidacy. I lost both my brother and my brother-in-law in the fight against Nazis. I'm not making a deal with Nazis. Let me also say that 2 days ago, he said that I had sold out on immigration, never done anything on immigration. It was our legislation before the Senate of the United States, which is before his committee, of which he's a member, which dealt with immigration. It was the Department of Justice who made the special arrangement to permit the Chinese to come in here. We are the first time that came out, first group, and the legislation was drawn up in the Department of Justice, came out against the national quota system, which he has not done. I think it's a difficult campaign.
Many of us have been wondering whether or not you were going to ever issue a concise statement on your position in regards to the McCarthy hearings and the purges of Senator Joseph McCarthy. Would you be willing to offer a statement now?
I went to work in 1953 for the committee that was headed by Senator McCarthy. There was a Democratic counsel for that committee. Mr. Flanagan was kept over from the previous committee headed by the Democrats. He hired me. I went to work for him. I was not involved in any of the communist hearings of Senator McCarthy during that period of time, which I worked for the committee. I worked for the committee for approximately 6 months. I disagreed with what was happening on the committee, which I did not have any personal involvement, but other things that they were doing, I was a member of the staff. I reached the conclusion that I didn't want to have anything to do with it. So I went to Senator McCarthy, and I said that I disagreed with what they were doing, and I wasn't going to stay with the committee any longer. And I left in June of 1953. I went then with the Hoover Commission. The Democratic members also walked off the committee. I left the committee. I went to the Hoover Commission. In February of 1954, the Democrats came back on the committee. They had enough confidence in me that they hired me as their counsel to represent them. I went through the Army McCarthy hearing as the counsel for the Democrats, with the counsel of Senator McClellan, Senator Symington, Senator Jackson. I was the one that wrote the report on Senator McCarthy and the Army McCarthy hearings. I wrote that report, and which was signed by the Democratic members and was written by me. So that's my record. I believe at a rather young age I stood up on the question of principle.
Since you haven't lived in New York State recently, do you feel that you understand the state's problems today?
Well, I think I do. As I said earlier, I think that the fact that I've been involved in all of these matters, I mean, the effort that was made in Harlem dealing with young people were set up by me as chairman of the Committee on Juvenile Delinquency. HARU and ACT, those efforts were made, the effort that was made up in the city of Syracuse, set up by me as chairman of the Committee on Juvenile Delinquency. The great problem, I would think, in the state of New York now is to make sure that people of different races and colors can live together. There's been nobody that's been more in the center of that than I have over the period of the last 3.5 years. Or the question of employment, the question of housing, that effort, and the question of education, those efforts are all, I was intimately involved in all of those efforts over the period of the last 3.5 years in the administration. They had an effect in the state of New York, bringing new industry into the state of New York, bringing new industry, making sure there are enough jobs. That came about through the tax cut and the depreciation allowance that we put through in 1963. All of these matters were matters in which I was intimately involved in. I was directly involved in. I was involved in the consultation and the drawing up of the legislation. And as I say, even beyond that, it's a question of survival. And I've been involved in that. So I think I understand the problem. The state, I've been all over this state now. And I've had a lot of press conferences, and a lot of questions have been asked of me. If Anybody can ask me a question about any matter that involves the state of New York and find out whether I know what I'm talking about. That's the easiest way. I've opened myself to all of you. If I don't know the problems of the state of New York, then it should be demonstrated by asking me a question to find out if my answer makes any sense.
Sir, you mentioned the question of housing, and on this specific issue, it's well known that the problems of New York City are perhaps larger than any other area. What specifically would you do, which hasn't been done before, to bring better housing programs to the city of New York and to the entire state of New York?
Well, first, there are a million people, as you point out, there are a million people who are living in substandard and overcrowded housing in the city of New York. There are another million outside the city of New York. Actually, as much or more has been done about housing in the city of New York as any other city comparable or any other large city in the United States. The problem is that New York's bigger than any other city. So the result is there are greater problems here than any other place. As far as public housing is concerned, I'd extend that program and expand it. I'd also expand the program for middle income housing. I'd also make an effort for urban renewal in a different with different emphasis than there is at the present time. I try to rehabilitate some of the establishments that are now in existence rather than just knocking them down. I'd also make more of an effort to take care of those who are moved out in a urban renewal program. They get moved out of one area, there's a more expensive project that's placed in that area, they can't afford the rent, what happens to them? They go back into another slum. So we're not really dealing with the slum problems. So I would have more of an emphasis on that. I'd also put greater emphasis on providing housing for people over the age of 65. We have more people over the age of 65 living in this state than any other state of the Union, almost 2 million. A million of them live under poverty conditions. Widows in the state of New York, on the average, live on an income of $880 a year. Well, you can't get by with that. There are twice as many people over the age of 65 percentage-wise who are living in overcrowded and substandard housing than those under the age of 65. So I'd make a special effort to help them. Let me just say, I run for the United States Senate because I think it's such an important position, because I want to play a role. And I saw over the period of the last 3.5 years, and I say this to you, some of you who support my candidacy and some who do not, more in a nonpartisan way, and I saw in the last 3.5 years really what a difference an individual can make. And if I saw anything or learned anything, it was really that. And I think particularly those who are educated and those of you such as yourselves, those of you who took the effort to come here tonight are interested in politics, are interested in government. I think to continue that interest after you leave college is absolutely essential if we're going to have success in this country and success in this state and success in the world. And I saw it, whether it be in the Peace Corps, I saw it with people that headed up agencies and departments, the fact that they showed some initiative or showed some imagination or were willing to go out into areas that had never been attacked before. That's what made the difference in the government over the period in the last 3.5 years. It's not that we made the problems disappear, but it was that kind of an effort. And I think that that's what we need in the United States over the period of the next 10 years. As President Kennedy said, we have the capacity to make this the best generation in the history of mankind or make it the last. I think that we can make it the best generation. But I think really it's going to rest with those who are educated, those people who are trained, whether they are going to participate or whether they're going to say this is the problem or responsibility of somebody else. That's why I think that all of you who have had the advantage of an education here, just as I've had the advantage of an education, that we have a special and particular responsibility. When we look and analyze where our government came from, or our system of government, where it originated, we think back to the Greeks and what their idea really was of participation, and what Pericles said in his funeral oration, that we differ from other states in that we regard the individual who holds himself aloof from public affairs as being useless, and yet we yield to no one in our independence of spirit and complete self-reliance. I think that's what has to guide us. And the Greeks, the word idiot, coming from that individual who didn't participate, who wasn't actively involved. President Kennedy's favorite quote was really from Dante, that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who in time of moral crisis preserve their neutrality. So if all of us, whether it's in the field of civil rights or housing or whether it's in Vietnam or whatever it is, just hang back and say this is a problem of somebody else. If we're going to permit what's going on in Harlem now, of those young children grow up uneducated and untrained and dissatisfied with life and dissatisfied with their future and feeling that there is nothing in this system, then we're going to be in difficulty. Even if we look at this selfishly, we're going to be in difficulty. The whole system's going to be in difficulty. Sophocles said one time, well, what joy is there in the day that follows day, some swift, some slow, with death the only goal. And really, that's what many of our fellow citizens, whether they're in Appalachia or whether they're in Harlem, or whether they're the white children that live in some of these other areas where there's no future, or even our elderly people over the age of 65 who feel that there's not any future for them, that all they're going to do is die and get sick and go have to take a pauper's oath. These, I think, are our responsibilities. These are your responsibilities, just as they are mine. Now, I hope that I win as the United States Senator, but even if I don't, I think that for all of us, that we have an obligation. We have a responsibility. If we don't do it, then nobody's going to do it. And if educated people don't do it, then nobody's going to do it. And the people that are going to make the difference for this country and for the world are educated people. And we have a special, not only responsibility, but a special opportunity to make a difference in the world and make a difference for this country. And that's really what I come to say to you. I think of what Archimedes said, and perhaps it's a little explaining the lever. And he said, show me where I can stand and I can move the world. And I think that we can. I think that we started it 3.5 years ago, and I think we can continue it. And I don't think it's just a question of political belief, but I think that we can make a difference. And so, thank you.
Robert F. Kennedy, speaking to students at Columbia University. And that brings us to the end of our program today. I thank you for listening. Keep it right here at PRN. Up next, Infectious Myth with David Crow. We'll see each other tomorrow. Thanks for listening. ¶¶